The Low End Theory is the title of the album. As far as I remember, the title is never really explained on the record anywhere, but has generally been interpreted to refer to the idea that there is a sort of affinity between bass culture, bass-driven music, and the relatively low position of black people or black men in a social hierarchy. The low end is a phrase which can refer to both. I mean, low end means like low rent, low status, low class. It's a term you use in sort of hi-fi culture, actually, to refer to poor quality, cheap equipment. But also the low end refers to the low end of the frequency spectrum in audio terms, the bass frequencies. And the idea of the idea that there is a politics, a social politics to a sonic and musical aesthetics, which emphasizes bass, is an idea which has been pretty clearly articulated in music and what we might call musical discourse since the days of dub and reggae. I think this point in time, the point of both the golden age of hip hop, but also the very moment of the genesis of what would become drum and bass, and also the moment when dub has really reached a certain level of prestige beyond just reggae fans, as we saw in the last episode about dub, actually. This is an idea that really sort of comes into its own around this time in history, around the beginning of the 90s. And it's an idea that gets picked up on by theorists of sound and theorists of music culture a bit later. I guess probably the most developed exploration of this as a theoretical theme is in a very recent book by Paul C. Jason. Jason's spelled J-A-S-E-N, an American scholar, and his book is simply called The Low-End Theory: Bass Bodies and the Materiality of Sonic Experience. But it's an idea which is there in Julian Enriquez's book, Sonic Bodies, in Steve Goodman's book, Sonic Warfare. And indeed, it's an idea that we put forward and explored a little bit in the book I wrote with Ewan Pearson in 1999, Discographies. I'm not sure actually if we don't explore it at huge length, but we sort of refer to it as we allude to this as an idea, and I don't know if anybody did before that. People who were writing, in the process of writing PhDs about rave and dance, and especially people into jungle and drum and bass, were sort of onto this as a theory in the second half of the 90s.
And I think people who've written about bass in general in music will often refer to the way that it could kind of, you know, reverberates, you know, through matter, and yeah, it's felt in the body. So
I think in terms of academic publishing, there's just not a lot of people writing about that before the late 90s.
Yeah, it's interesting. You might be right.
Yeah, because there was a lot of people talking about it in sort of seminars and things, and not a lot of stuff got published. But, you know, in terms of the academic scholarship, the big like bass culture research project going on at the University of Westminster is sort of still ongoing now. It's something that's happening now. It's not.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering about maybe Trisha Rose. Trisha Rose would probably did this in.
Well, yeah. Well, she does talk. I mean, Trisha Rose, there isn't a lot of sort of abstract conceptualization in that book, in Black Noise, but she does talk about. She sort of talks about bass as one of the aesthetic priorities.
Exactly.
As she puts it, of black music. But it's not so much for her. It's not bass as such, which is a really big deal. It's rhythm and percussion and sort of repetition. And I think it's the emphasis on bass as such is something that really you get much more of kind of after drum and bass. And after drum and bass has really kind of focused a lot of people's minds on the legacy of dub. I mean, it's something that people, I don't think we've really got into yet on the show, really.
But yeah, we'll come back to it, won't we?
Yeah. But anyway, to explain the theory a bit more, I mean, in some ways, it's a very simple kind of theoretical point that, look, bass frequencies are registered in the body, the corporeal body of the human being, in a way that higher frequencies are not. So, I mean, and then not just the human being, actually, but the physical world of solid matter. And this is a really simple point. You can see it if you have loud enough speakers in your at home, and you can certainly see it out near a sound system anywhere. It's the bass frequencies that physically reverberate, that physically make objects shake. And there is a basic physical, you know, basic physics explanation for this, which is that you can, if you follow sort of basic electromagnetic physics, you can identify almost all kind of energy and matter in the universe as vibrating according to particular frequencies. And this is true of solid matter. It's true just of the desk in front of me, that the molecules that make it up are vibrating all the time. If they weren't, they would be in a state of stasis and would cease to exist as matter in some sense, arguably. I mean, they would still exist, but they wouldn't hold this kind of shape that they do. And the same is true of light, of all forms of energy up to light rays. And there are differences between the ways in which particles operate at an atomic and subatomic level. So there's a difference between the way in which photons behave and the way in which, you know, the molecules that make up desks and sound waves behave. But broadly speaking, the thing to understand here is that, to put it very crudely, you know, light moves at a faster vibration than sound, and such that only very, very sensitive parts of the body can register changes in light. And that's basically only the sensitive cells in your arm.
Does light even move as a vibration?
Well, it gets really complicated. Yeah. Light is made of photons, which behave like both waves and particles, and you really get into quantum physics here, which I'm not qualified to.
Yeah, no, I just thought somehow that indeed light behaves in a complete, travels in a very different way to sound. But anyway, let's move on.
Yeah, well, it does. It travels a lot faster, and it doesn't have to pass through a material medium. That's the point. It doesn't have to go through a material medium. That's why we can see light from the stars thousands of light years away, or hundreds of light years away, because the light can travel through the vacuum of space, whereas sound can't.
We don't feel light when we see light. We don't feel it.
Yeah, exactly. So that, and according to the same logic, we don't feel high frequencies in the same way that we feel bass frequencies. They are arguably, high frequencies do sort of register with the body and the skin, but they don't register to nearly the same extent. The argument made by people like myself, and influenced really by theorists like Roland Barthes, by critical musicologists like Susan McClary and John Shepherd, their argument has been that, well, if you think about Trisha Rose's phrase, aesthetic priorities, the idea that within particular musical traditions, there are particular aesthetic priorities. In other words, at least to a minimal extent, most of the features of music will have to be present in most of what we recognize as music. So orchestral music of the Germanic, European tradition, what most people today call classical music, it clearly has rhythm, it has percussion, but it's also clear that rhythm, percussion, repetition are not aesthetic priorities within that tradition. The aesthetic priorities within that tradition are melody, harmony and melodic extension. In other words, the use of harmonies to enable large groups of instruments to play themes together, to play melodic themes together, and melodic extension meaning the elaboration of melodic themes. So you listen to a symphony and you don't get like lots and lots of repetition. You get some melodic themes developed over a very long period of time that achieve tonal resolution only after like an hour and a half or something. You can also say that those sort of Western aesthetic priorities are also manifested in mainstream pop music, to the extent that although melodic extension is not a big part of pop music, it's still mainly about melody. It's mainly about the high register. It's about the high register using synth or guitar or voice, in the same way that the classical orchestra places a really high emphasis on the string section and especially the violin. and the upper range of the piano, which is part of the percussion section technically. But
yeah, and there was this thing with Berry Gordy deliberately not emphasizing the low end in order for his music to appeal to the widest possible market, right?
Yeah, well, when we think about music having become whiter in any context, starting at least with Motown, indeed, we think of the bass being filtered out. We think of strings being added. We think of the voices going into a higher register, etc. Now, from that point of view, on the one hand, then, well, the most obvious thing to say is while all music in the Black diasporic tradition, the Afro-diasporic tradition, has to some extent changed and challenged those aesthetic priorities of the European, really Northern European bourgeois musical tradition, arguably there has never been a purer challenge to them than dub. The idea that you really emphasize the bass more than anything else, to the extent that there is any melody at all, it's being played by the bass guitar in a few notes. But one of the features of listening to dub is the fact that the distinction almost between percussion, bass and melody gets blurred, gets dissolved by the very act of having this very heavy, very high in the mix bass becoming the thing that a lot of the time carries the tune. You emphasize rhythm, and not just rhythm, but as with James Brown's funk, you emphasize the rhythmic qualities and properties of almost all sound. You're using found sound, you're using vocal tracks that are being chopped in order to make what had been just melodic elements of the track also percussive rhythmic elements of the track. And there is this sense in which, from that point of view, dub, reggae in general, but dub in particular, is the sort of purest expression, the purest reversal of those aesthetic priorities. And this obviously has implicit political connotations. And I think that is the best explanation of why so many people, so many producers, musicians, listeners over the years have immediately heard in dub something incredibly radical, something incredibly subversive. Because, of course, those aesthetic priorities of the Western tradition are also deeply associated with a set of philosophical and aesthetic and ethical and political ideas which privilege cerebral experience over physical experience, and they privilege masculine experience over feminine experience, and they privilege whiteness over all of its others, and they privilege elite bourgeois or aristocratic experience and perspectives over those of everybody else. You know, we could get into a whole thing about, you know, Bakhtin and the idea that the celebration of the body always has a kind of democratic quality, whereas bourgeois culture and to a lesser extent aristocratic culture before it, elite cultures have tended to denigrate any sort of experience of the body, any sort of physical experience, because to be more bodily is to be in some discourses it's to be more animalistic, and whether it is or not, it's always to be sort of more common. It's to express those aspects of experience which all human beings share, not just people who've had access to expensive education and sort of been able to cultivate those sensibilities. So the idea of making a real art form, a very self-conscious, experimental, self-consciously political and spiritual art form out of really reversing those aesthetic priorities is a very immediately radical gesture which dub engages in. And I think that's why it's seen as an obvious resource for some of the most intellectually and politically articulate hip-hop artists, as well as for so many other artists, for so many other perspectives.